This Edgar Profiles podcast is supported by Ping. Edgar is an association of national federations formed in the year 2000 to develop and encourage initiatives which raise the awareness of golf, both as a participation and competitive sport for individuals with disability. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Your host for this episode is Tony Bennett. Ping. Play your best.
My guest today was an easy target for bullies. Imagine just for a moment that you were brought up in a sports-mad country. Jeff Nicklaus had a form of thalidomide which affected both legs from the knees down and which eventually resulted in the amputation of his right leg. In this conversation, Jeff explains that he had to wear special iron shoes, but that he stood up to the bullies and that in the end it probably made him a stronger person. Jeff takes us through how he fashioned a homemade club out of wood to give golf a try. His years as an aspiring golfer, how he became a scratch golfer representing his state, and how he dominated amputee golf for more than a decade. Please enjoy my conversation with Jeff Nicklaus.
Ping. Play your best.
Good to get together with you, Jeff. Really good to get together with you.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a few years since we talked.
Yeah, I remember we met at that, you know,
Boxgorgon, it was.
Yeah.
And how's life down in Sydney?
It's been quite cold, actually. We've had a lot of rain and so. For this time of year, we haven't had a day over 20, which is unusual.
Okay. That is unusual for you guys.
Yeah. So we've got a couple of big weeks coming up in November.
Absolutely, you have, yeah. I bet you're looking forward to that, aren't you?
Yeah, we've done a few media things already, you know, with it, so with the PGA Tour. So they're really backing it, which is great. That'll be terrific, and it's good with Christian Hamilton. You never met Christian, you
know? I know Christian quite well now, yeah. In fact, funnily enough, I was speaking to Christian earlier this morning.
Oh, yeah, he's been sort of the very instrumental in doing a lot of this too.
Yeah.
So he's good.
No, he's a good man. And what about you? What about your golf? Are you playing well?
Reasonably. I'm playing the seniors tour over here in Australia, the PGA seniors tour. Not a real lot because I've got a 3-year-old.
Right, okay.
Which is keeping me busy.
Oh, it is.
Which is keeping me busy.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, so I've the last couple of months I've started to play a bit, and I played in that one in Queensland. I thought, well, I just wanted to get a bit of a run. I had a good. The form there was quite good, so.
So you're looking forward to the summer now, because obviously you're coming into your spring, yeah?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, spring and summer, like, because November can be quite hot too, but not boiling hot, but, you know, it can be quite hot.
Yeah. Well, look, Jeff, thanks for making the time to get together with me today, and I assume, have I caught you at home today?
Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah.
So where is home for you?
Sylvania Waters is a place. Remember there's a TV show?
Yeah.
Sylvania Waters?
I remember the name. I don't remember ever seeing it, but I remember the name.
Yeah. That's where I'm. It's about 20 minutes from the city centre.
Okay. On what side is that?
South side.
On the south side, right. You've been a kind of a flag bearer for Golf for the Disabled for probably a few more years than you'd care to mention, but
I mean, yeah.
I guess I'd like to start at the beginning. So, I mean, clearly Australia is very famous for its outdoor lifestyle and, you know, sport. And I know you and I have maybe talked on cricket and rugby on a couple of occasions. So we're not going to go there, but I'd like to talk to you a little bit about how did you get started in sport and in golf?
Well, I really started because even as a kid, as a youngster, when I was in like 7 and 8, I just loved watching football. But it was a sport I couldn't really play because with my legs. And when I was 11, I had the operation to take the right leg off because it didn't grow, obviously, from the birth defect, and I took up the game of golf a year later.
Okay.
And I didn't really play any other sports for that reason, that for my leg, but I wanted to, but yeah, it was just a bit too hard.
So tell me about the birth defect. So it's a congenital disability that you had in your right leg.
Yeah, well, actually, I had thalidomide.
Okay.
I was born with thalidomide and affected both legs from the knees down, the right and the left, and I was missing the fibula bone, which is the outside bone on both legs, and both the ankles were missing. But the left leg was the right leg was a little bit more deformed. So it didn't grow like the left, even though the left's missing quite a lot of bones in that, but they had to – I was about 6 inches shorter on that leg, so that's why they waited till I got to that age and they took the leg off at below, right at the foot.
Right. So did you know all along that once you got to around about 11 years of age that your leg was going to come off?
Yeah, my parents sort of knew, and I knew, because the foot was pretty badly deformed anyway. It wasn't like it was a and they said the doctors, because we consulted the doctors, and they said, well, you're gonna have a shoe, but you're gonna be 6 inches higher as you grow older, even higher. And they said it was probably better to have it off, so you keep your hips all the one level, and wear an artificial limb, and that's what happened. But even that age, I knew it was going to happen, but you're sort of in Disneyland a little bit, you're not knowing what's the consequences are going to be.
What was it like growing up at school? Because as we mentioned, Australia and sport's a big deal, and you would obviously have to sit out a fair amount of that. Did you get any kind of, pushback at school, or any kind of bullying or anything such like at school because of the
deformity? I got a lot of bullying because, obviously, and when I was even younger, because I had to wear the special iron shoes in the the lower grades, like after kindy and first and second grade, that they had to put me in with the girls because the boys were a bit rough.
Right.
So, and I always remember that. That was always tough. And you always had a few that pick on you, but you also had the others that would support you. And but I think in the long run, it probably makes you – depends how you take it, but I think it made me stronger.
Yeah.
Because, I stood up to it. I didn't like being pushed around. So in the end, it sort of helped me in life, made me a stronger person.
I think we'll come to that later when we're chatting, but
sure.
Certainly Australia seems to have changed a lot, as many countries have. I'm not picking out Australia on this one. Many countries have changed.
Mm-hmm.
I think Australia particularly has got a much more inclusive attitude to people with disability than many other countries, and it seems to it's kind of gone 180 degrees. It's really changed a lot.
Oh, it has, definitely, yeah. No, it's – and, like, because even you saw the Commonwealth Games, they included the disabled golfers in amongst the able-bodied golfers, which is a terrific thing. And now this with the golf here, it's sort of the – no other country's done it to play it actually on a PGA Tour event,
Yeah.
So I think it's – it's terrific that – that's happened in Australia too. So I think sport, because everyone's sports minded, and and that's the thing. I think it's all because this country is a lot about sport.
Yeah. You only started to play, as you said earlier, after your amputation. And so mm-hmm. who was it that first put a golf club in your hand and got you started?
It was actually just myself. I'd always hit a cricket bat, throw the ball up against the wall and hit. I used to love doing that, and I hit a tennis racket into the walls. And then one day I just saw golf on television, and I just went out in the street with a bit of wood,
right.
And I bashed a ball in the street. Back then there was no cars, so that was... So
you're not that old. So there was few cars, yeah, not
a few cars, not many though where we were. So yeah, and that's how I started, and I went out with my brother, and then I decided well at school I went said to a friend, "You want to go and play nine holes?" And ever since that, like it might have been a week later, and I just got the bug. You know, I wanted to be there all the time on the golf course.
So there was nobody else in your family that played? You had no kind of reference point in the family?
Nah, no one else played golf, nah.
So had it not been for TV, you might not have seen the game?
That's right, yeah. Although I was very much, I did love sport. I used to like rugby league and cricket, followed cricket, like the test series with Australia and England. I'd sort of follow every ball, and I loved all that, and I'd sort of cut out things, and you know, I used to love stats and all that sort of thing. So, but yeah, and then golf come along. And the reason I liked it so much because I could actually participate in it myself. So,
yeah, so tell me a little bit more about that, because I think that's a big thing. I've spoken to many people, and oftentimes it is the opportunity to participate on a level playing field, the independence of being able to go and play without having to be in a team. Do either of those things resonate with you?
Yeah, obviously, you know, I would have loved to play in a team, but obviously golf being an individual sport, but it was a game where I could just go out and when I was growing up learning to play the game, I could just go out and have a practice myself and just sort of organise myself, and that's why it's such a great game, because you don't need anyone else to help you along. It's, if you want to do it, you go and do it yourself. So
did you start in a program, or was it exactly as you said, you just kind of did it as you went along?
I just went along, and I turned up on the first tee, and I always remember I had an old set of wooden clubs, and I think I had 14 or 15 on my first hole. But I just loved it, you know, sort of. And I really didn't have a lesson for about maybe 2 years after I started.
Yeah. And I suppose you could do that down there because there was an availability of golf facilities, golf courses, I guess. So you were, was it pretty close to your house?
Oh, yes, yeah. And it wasn't expensive, you know, like golf in Australia is quite cheap and there was a lot of courses. Yeah, we had... Where we live, we had four or five courses within, 5 kilometres. So that, and it's affordable, and everyone sort of there's a lot of kids there playing, which was at the time. So,
do you keep in contact with any of those kids? Have you still in?
Yeah, actually, I do. Yeah, some of the kids. Well, not when I very very first started, because they were a couple mates from school, which I've never. They moved on, but some of the kids I used to play one of them plays on the seniors tour.
Really?
With me, and he played the PGA tour too, so actually he did a traineeship.
Excellent.
And then he played the tour. Yeah.
Excellent. You kind of trundled along then, playing some golf, and then it seems like around about age 20, you joined the Lakes Golf Club. In fact, the Lakes is where they're going to play the Triple AC. in a few weeks.
That's
time.
It, yeah.
But you joined the Lakes Golf Club, as I say, when you were about 20. So can you tell me how that had an effect on you and your game?
Yeah, that was probably a turning point, because I played the courses I was at. You know, they were like, they're nice courses, but they were just in like sort of a B grade style course. But I always wanted to join a championship course, and I had a game out at the Lakes, and I just sort of, I loved it. So I found a way to join. It wasn't that hard back then, because a lot of clubs were short of memberships in the early 80s. I went to the club and they got me in, and I think I was off 9 or something like that when I first went there. So I didn't really all that year. Took a while, even though I was practicing a lot. It was a very slow process in getting my handicap down.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't sort of fall straight away like you see some kids. You know, it was a very slow process. And I joined the Lakes, and I was off 9, and, you know, 4 or 5 years later, I got down to scratch.
What do you put that down to?
I was sort of in, I don't know, over the period, I kept improving, you know, even when I was young, like improving all the time, and I was very dedicated. I spent a lot of time practicing. And you know, I worked really hard at my game, and I wanted to really improve. So I'd say the number one would be practicing, spending a lot of time on the game, and just, I think it was a slow process, but it probably a good way to do it. You know, you learn a lot more too by that way.
And I mean, it looks like for the next, I don't know, were you working or studying as well at the same time?
Back then, no, I worked in the bank for 7 years when I left school. So while I was doing all this, while I was joining the Lakes, so I was in the bank. So I worked in the bank in town. So and you'd finish at 3, so you could practice in the afternoon, because, you know, we had, especially in the summer, you had the long hours.
Yeah.
So I would always spend the time. But and then after I left the bank, my family, we bought a sandwich shop, and I worked with my mother, and that was mainly to so I could play a bit more golf, you know, have a bit more free time.
Yeah.
And that's the reason we had that for 4 or 5 years.
So for these and next then, sort of 9 years or so, you kind of just played your golf, did your work, practiced.
Yep.
And then suddenly, almost like an overnight success, which we know is never true, but all of a sudden your career, you know, it really took off, and you were probably around about 30 years of age then, I guess.
What
was it in the year before, or maybe the 18 months before, that turned you from being a regular type player into a top competitor?
That's a good question. I think it's all the time that it was a slow build up, and I think it was the more I played, and you know, when you're always out there trying to shoot your first par round, and you know you're trying, and once you get it you get another goal, and I think that was it. I sort of got close to par or broke par a couple of times. Then and then I was playing pennants for the Lakes, and you know, a couple of times in my matches I was under par, well under par, winning my games. So I think it was, and it created a lot of confidence then, and I think that's what it come down to. I become confident, and when you, as you say, when you get gain confidence, it helps. You got to be confident when you're out there playing. So.
Yeah, kinds of confidence breeds confidence, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting that you said that, you know, you started to see some results, and I assume that would be in match play when you were playing those. Did you call it the pennants?
Yeah, that match
pennants
play,
tournaments?
Yeah. Yeah, and I won a couple of amateur tournaments then too. I got selected in the New South Wales side. It was like a country city game. I got selected in the city side, and that was the top 12 amateurs in the state. So I got selected in that. Because I was playing at once I got to in, the, I was playing number one for the Lakes. I got down to number one, and we had two winning guys that represented Australia, Colin Kay and Trevor Wood. And because I beat both of them in the final of the club championships, so that sort of helped me move up the. Yeah, that gave me a little bit of recognition too with the Golf Association. And, I just got confident and, you know, all that practice over the time was paying off, I think, yeah.
And I guess the majority of your golf, it seems like you've alluded to the fact that most of your golf was played and probably even today is played with able-bodied golfers.
So, yeah, sure, yeah. I was playing golf. I joined the club in 75, like as a junior. And really, my first real competitive game with an amputee group was in 89, so 14 years later.
Yeah.
And that was in the US. I played in the US amputee tournament.
I'm going to come to your record in Knowles in just a second, but you've raised a really interesting point because. It really wasn't. There wasn't much opportunity for golfers with disability, and so I'm sure that there was plenty of golfers with disability playing in regular golf.
And and I think there was, and I think that back then, the reason I back then we didn't have internet or anything like that, and you couldn't Google anything. So I wrote to the USGA and asked them if there was any. Amputee bodies, and they wrote back to me and said there was NAG and National Amputee Golf. So I wrote to them, and then they sent me a list of their tournaments. It was back and forth. It wasn't sort of like you can in the internet now straight away. You know, go wait for the letter and that sort of thing. So, and that's how I first come across. I thought there's got to be something in that you know a group of amputees that play together. And that's where I found it.
Well, I mean, your record in disabled golf from 1989 onwards, or really from probably the all of the 90s and the 2000s, your record is truly dominant. You've got a string of victories and you've got, I assume you've got a trophy cabinet full of mementos. If I'm not mistaken, now, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you can't believe everything that you read on the internet, but... 12 British Opens, 12 US Opens, 5 Canadian Opens, 4 Japanese Opens, 3 Australian Opens, a Korean Open, a New Zealand Open. I mean, you've rightly been called the world's leading amputee golfer for a long time. So tell me what it was like going through that period where, because obviously you embraced it, but what was it like going through that period where everyone looked at you as the man and...
Yeah,
I suppose in most cases you single-handedly led the charge for golf for the disabled at that time.
Yeah, it was quite funny because it was 1990 when I won my first one, and then 91 I went for my PGA Tour card in Australia, and I got it for the 92 season. So I was playing like amputee golf. And I was also playing the PGA Tour, and it was funny. It's a funny feeling because when I was playing the amputee golf, I felt like I know how Greg Norman would have felt. You know, you turn up there and you didn't think anyone was going to beat you, and you know, and you get this real confidence, and you just feel like you just feel like you're the king in a nice way, not
not in an arrogant way. That's for sure.
And when I played back on the PGA Tour, it was more like I didn't have that sort of same zested in the PGA, because on the PGA Tour, I was actually just satisfied to have qualified, and it was probably not a good thing, but, you know, I was just happy to be out there playing, and even if I didn't get the high level, just competing on the tour, I was very satisfied with that. So it was a funny feeling, and that went through all my career, really. I sort of, even though I did play well in a few events, it was sort of like playing in having two different roles.
Yeah, I think you've been a little bit modest when you say that you didn't do fantastically well there. You played against players like Greg Norman, Peter Senior, a whole bunch of the guys that were really good players down there. And I believe you played with a certain Tiger Woods, or not with him perhaps, but in the same tournament as he did.
Yeah, it was 96 Australian Open, and that was one of his first tournaments as a professional overseas, that was. And it was just the first round he shot a 79 and I had a 76. It was horrendous conditions. It was like so hard. And so I let him by three shots after the first round. But we both made the cut actually in that tournament. So, but he ended up beating me overall. But just beating him in one round was good. And actually that same tournament, Greg Norman won that tournament. But there was guys like, I know the cut that year was nine over, and it was so hard. Greens, you know, it was just brutal.
Yeah. Tell me, how did the professionals, of which you yourself were one by now, how did they treat you?
Oh, no, just, this, you know, that was a good thing. That's why I enjoyed it, because it was just like, I was just one of the other lads, you know. It wasn't no different. I mean, a lot of them respected me for what I've done, you know, or was doing, but yeah, no, it was. That's why I really enjoyed it. That the terrific group of guys I played with too. So, and now a lot of those guys are joining the seniors.
Right.
So I haven't seen them for a while, and they're catching up with them now. So, but no, overall, and that's one thing in golf, like that's what I did notice, that everyone is trying out there to help someone. You know, their game's not on, they're all out there trying to help someone, which you don't get that in many other sports.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the traits of our profession,
game,
if you
like,
that, and our game, exactly, that, you know, on the field of play, we're competitors. For most of the time, we're not on the field of play. We've got another 4 or 5 hours of practice every day after we've played our round, and we go out there and, you know, very happy to share our ideas with other players. And I think you're right. I think everybody just gets on, and they try hard to help each other along. So it's good to hear
definitely
comments on that. I mean, pretty much all the way through your career, there's been real. There's not been much of a linkage, shall we say, of the federations. And today there's 28 federations that work together across the world. And we've got more applications that are coming together, and that we're receiving them pretty much all the time. And I guess that one of the things that's come from that is the ranking. And I suppose in all that time, even though your record says that you are the man for amputee golf particularly, but disabled golf in general, it was very difficult to prove that, I guess, except for the fact that you'd won these championships. Now I think with the ranking, you have that opportunity to compare yourself against others around the world. Tell me about what you think a meaningful world ranking means for golf.
I think it's a terrific idea. I think because, you know, if you look at any sport, they've got a ranking, and I think as a competitor, you're trying to climb the list, and as a spectator, you want to see who's on that list. That's one of the things that I think that's really progressed in the disabled in golf, you know, with that ranking. And And I think it's going to help, you know, obviously with down the track with trying to get in the Olympics or just to have a system. You know, if we needed a system. And before, a lot of these associations, when I first went to England, it was run by British Amputee Golf Association, but it was just run by one guy, and he did a terrific job, but then if something happens to him, the associations fall apart, and that's what happened quite a lot. Obviously, the American ones lasted since 1947, but a lot of the associations around the world, you know, they're put together by a group of people who are just doing it as a hobby, and then something happens to them, well, that then it all falls in a hole. Where this is going to be, that's why it's so good. Where you get all the, you know, get Golf Australia and yourselves and the RNA all involved, and it'll be a lot more steady. Like that. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. That's what I've noticed when I was playing from when I first started. That it was very paper thin. You know, like. Yeah. I was thinking, well, if something happened to this guy who was running the Association in Australia, well, who's going to take it over? There's no, it's not a job, it's just an interest. And that's where I think, well, this is why it's Golf Australia and it's come to the forefront the last couple of years, I think, and what you guys did with the European DGA, I think that's terrific. And it's, you know, you can see it's very professional, and that's, I think that's what we needed. People look at that and say, wow, that's good, yeah.
It certainly seems to be on the right track, and, you know, obviously.
Oh, definitely, yeah, I can, yeah, definitely.
I think with the number of federations that are joining and, you know, coming together, and I think that's the nice thing is that they're coming together and they're gathering around policies that make sense, and they make sense to golf. In general, as a overall sport, but they also make sense to golfers with disability as well. So, yeah, the R4GD is a product of that. The ranking, that is, it makes sense to everybody. So, yeah, that's good. Mm. And I guess that, you know, you've been at the top end of the game for quite a while, and obviously at the very top end of disabled golf. And so you've got a vantage point where you can see how all of these things link together, and, you know, for that.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah, I can see how it's yeah, obviously, I might have probably, you know, 20 years ago, if this all was happening now, I think it's going to be great for the future of disabled golf. Especially what's happening here in Australia, I think that's going to be the press are already very keen on it. So I think that's where we're going to be able to showcase a little bit there too.
Well, that showcase really does get a big boost in a few weeks' time. And so tell me a little bit about what the players are likely to find at the lakes. I'm pretty sure that you'll be in demand in the practice rounds. So you've got 11 guys and plus yourself, so there's the 12 of you, but you've got 11 guys that don't know the golf course quite like you know it. So I'm pretty sure that you'll be, as I say, in demand for the practice round. So what are they going to experience?
It's going to be, well, it's a type of course. It's like in November, it can be very windy. Sydney's a very windy city and the lakes is quite exposed, so. And the summer breezes will be blowing, so and get up to 30 to 35 knots. So it can be a bit British Open type style, now wind. And the greens are very undulating. It's a tough test, and but a lot of the players that are playing in it have got a bit of length. Probably one that been a bit older now, probably one of the shorter ones, but because we'll be playing the same conditions as the tournament players will be, so off the back tee, so it'll be a good test. The one thing is the fairways are a little bit generous, which is good. You know, But if you get off them, you'll know it. There's a lot of water.
Right.
But yeah, no, it's, and I think it's great that we're playing in like off the same plates and everything, and they're going to mix us in the field.
Yeah,
which is terrific. Mm.
Yeah, that's the power of it, because I think that, you know, if it was a separate event, you know, played another golf course or different tiers, that kind of thing, I think it would lose some of its impact. I think the very fact that the players are going to be playing exactly the same golf course, same tees, same time.
It's perfect. No, it's terrific,
Tell me a little bit about any coaches that have helped you to develop your game over the years. Have you worked with anybody? I know you didn't do it at the beginning, but have you worked with people in the interim period?
Oh, yeah, like most golfers, they're always looking for the secret. I've had Gary Edwin and Gary Barter, who were coaches here in Australia. Gary Edwin coached Pamplin at Peter, who coaches Peter Senior now. And so I think it's good. I learn a lot off each and every one of them. You know, you sort of, everyone's a little bit different, so I think that's how you learn. You know, you sort of, and we're always tinkering with your swing. Even now, you're still tinkering. That's why it's such a great game.
Yeah,
I think it's you never stop learning. That's what Hogan, you know, he was still learning when he, in his 70s.
That's for sure. And I get the impression, it's not hard to get that impression, to be honest, but golf has been essential for you. So can you walk me through what golf means to you and how it's had a positive impact on your life?
Oh, yeah, it's been, like obviously as a kid, you know, you lose your leg, it's sort of, and as soon as I took the game up, I never even thought about that anymore. You know, it was incredible. You're obviously out there all those hours, and you're concentrating, trying to. And it was just not only it was physically great, but mentally it was even, I think, even greater, because it really you learn so much. You know, you're with others, and you learn to respect others, and I think. And over my journey, I think it helped me so much, and that's why I still sort of love the game, because it's been so good to me, you know, over that period of even up to now. You know, it's helped me. You know, it's makes you forget, and it's what happens. And I think that's for anyone with a disability. I think that's why it's such a great game, because there's not many games that you get as a disabled athlete, you can sort of compete against. If you get good enough, you can compete against an able body. It's probably the only sport in the world that you can do that at equal playing fields. And that's why. That's why. And I think that's why I think this will be good. Like, it's the more, it's a type of game, and you can just walk away from it, and if you need a rest and come back. And but over my career, I've sort of except maybe for one injury where I was out for maybe 4 months. I've always played, you know, from 12 to even now. So
of all the things that you've learned from playing golf, are there two or three takeaways that you might think others might be able to learn from?
Yeah, I think one thing I've learned a lot is respect. Like, and that's what when I first started, you learn to respect people, and I think it's you learn people's characters when you're on a golf course. Actually, you can pick their characters. That's what I learned, and I think others can learn that. You know, and I just think it's a game where you can never stop learning.
If you had all the resources and you could make two or three decisions that would positively impact golf for the disabled, what would you do, Jeff?
I think if you had all the resources, I think it'd be great to build a big academy, maybe with your own course, mm-hmm. and you get people all over the world. And I think because when you, as an amputee, you know, when you start to mix with other amputees, they're a bit like it's a bit like seeing your brother or sister. You're very close because it's sort of, you're all in the same boat. And I think by getting a group and that's together, I think that's what I'd like to see, you know, a big academy and a golf course where people can maybe come and learn, you know, like they do on the tours and all that, you know, just more of a thing where they can come and learn probably life too, you know, that's what I'd be doing, yeah.
So I know that you coach a team of intellectually disabled golfers to compete in the uh-huh. Special Olympics, and I think you've done that yeah. for a while. Mm. And I know that you've also taught clinics for returned amputee veterans in the US. Mm. How do you think we can get more people with disability into the game, and what do you think we should be doing to attract them?
Well, I think the one thing is probably exposure, and I think that's what you guys and are creating. So that's the whole thing. It's by having these it creates interest, and us playing in these events coming up, that exposure. It's like anything. That's how you get people. They see it on television, and because you know, there's a lot of people out there that say, "Oh, they don't know where to go." But it's if you really want to find something, you can. This day and age, you can Google or look it up. You know, so it's not like it's that. Like when I was back there, you had to write letters and all that, so you can find it. But I think exposure is the big thing, and I think I have noticed over the last few years that it's been created by like with the disabled athletes, not only in golf but other sports are starting to come to the forefront. You know, with the Commonwealth Games, people watch that, and now the Paralympics, which is getting bigger by the every 4 years, you know, and now we're actually in Sydney next week. You've got the Invictus Games, which actually I'm playing in the pro-am for that. So,
Good luck with
that. That things like that and all these things and are exposing, and that's how people. Once they see that, a bit of exposure, they think, oh, wow, that's maybe something I can do. So,
yeah, I think you're right. I think the exposure today is really important, obviously. Many people their lives on the internet, don't they? And
yeah, and then you see, when we'd get a little bit of – when I used to win those events, I'd sort of back in Australia, I'd get a bit of exposure, say, because he's done this and done that. But it's not like – actually going out playing this is by us playing in this event, this is going to be a great opportunity, and especially with all the caliber of golfers that are playing too, I think it's going to be great exposure.
Yeah, I think you're right. Have you got somebody who's going to walk in your door in a minute and steal your computer?
That's the backyard. Sorry.
So, look, what do you think the future holds for you, Jeff?
Well, I'm 57 now, so with a 3-year-old, so sort of started a bit late. But no, I'm still I'm obviously, you know, I enjoy playing the seniors, the PGA. I haven't played a lot just, you know, with the baby and that, but obviously. I'd like to help, you know, with these, I'm excited. That's why I've started to play a bit and practice a bit more with these events. I think this will be great for the future for disabled golf around the world. So, and you know, if it kicks off here, you know, it might be something in England or America or whatever. So, there'll be a little bit more exposure. I think that's what I'd sort of looking down the track, maybe still playing in that, but obviously once you get into your 60s, you're probably starting to beat it. Not probably be as competitive, but I've still got the competitive juices flowing, so I'll just see what happens.
Yeah, I'm sure you will do, and I'm sure you'll be competitive for a long time still. You're right in what you say, is that this hopefully will kickstart a number of different things, and it's been a long time in the making because, I remember it was only 3 years ago that we had the Portugal Masters on the European Tour. We had six players playing a kind of an exhibition, we'll call it, where they played the 18th hole with tour players, and that's gradually grown, and that's happened a bit, you know, for the last 3 years, and now we've got the USGA, they've made a commitment to do an official US Open. The IGF have made a commitment to do an official World Championship. The EGA are now running, that's the European Golf Association, are running the official European Championship for golfers with disabilities. So all of these things are beginning to gather pace, and you know, I think it's down the road, very, very soon down the road. I think there will be a kind of a world tour, if you like, for golfers with disability. But I think also there will be many, many more opportunities where top players, regardless of their ability, will compete together. And I think this can only be a good thing.
I think it'd be terrific for golf because in the end, you know, a person with a disability is obviously you'd rather not be there, but obviously and it can happen to anyone. You know, you can be something can happen, you have an accident, and that's what happens. And so, whether you can be a top line tour player and have an accident, and then you think your career's over, but you can still, there's still something else out there for you, you know. And the ones, the young kids, sort of trying to start, they can see all this, and it's sort of inspiring for them too, that they can play in all these events. So.
Yeah, I think that's true. If we think about, we'll call it regular golf, the mainstream game, is that right now we've got women's sections, male sections, we'll call them mid-amateur sections, senior sections, junior sections, under 18s, under 21s, under 16s, all kinds of different sections. Yeah. But actually, we all play the same game. And I suppose for many years, many federations didn't have a golfers with disability section. And of course, now they're beginning to get that. And yes, the juniors, and I use Rory McIlroy as a good example of that, who for many years played under 14 golf, under 16 golf, under 18 golf, under 21 golf. And yet he would do that maybe once or twice or three times a year. But then the rest of the time he was competing with everybody else because he was able to play in both categories, and I think that was great. You're living proof of that. So I've got a question here which I like to ask. I like to ask it as we approach the end of the interview, and we've had some fantastic answers on this. And the question really is, if you could magically be with someone who has a similar disability to yourself, what advice would you want to offer them? And I'm going back now to perhaps when you were just a youngster, 7, 8 years of age. What advice would you want to give that 7, 8 year of age, or that 11-year-old who's just had the amputation? What advice would you want to give to them?
I'd say. You know, it's going to be tough, but, you know, you've just got to you're going to obviously have your ups and downs. Like, it's just like life, you know, like a share market, you know, it goes up and goes down, up and goes up. It's a bit like life. I think with someone with a disability, you know, you go down, it's sometimes harder to get back up again. But and with me, because I had the game of golf, that wasn't that hard. You know, I could sort of, you know, obviously you have your rough times, but I always had golf there and a sport. And I think any kind of sport, whether it's golf or tennis or something, you know, obviously it's a bit harder with a disability playing a few other sports, but I think a sport can really help you, and that's sort of helped me, not so much physically and mentally. I think, and obviously if you can't play a sport, there's always something there that you've got to keep your mind active, I always say there's always someone worse than you, you know. And you see, you know, I look at people, you know, in wheelchairs, and there is your, in the end, I think when you have a disability, a lot of times you look at other people and think, God, how lucky am I? Whereas you haven't got anything wrong with you, you don't sort of look at it that way. That's my advice, yeah.
Good advice, yeah. If somebody wanted to just contact you, wanted to drop you a note or get some advice from you.
Oh, yeah. How can they just find my you? email or my mobile. I don't mind people ringing. That's fine.
Okay, perfect, perfect. Are you okay then if we just put that on the end of the article?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, anyone. Yeah, I like to talk to anyone. So.
And, Jeff, I'll see you down there. We'll share a beer, I'm sure, and we'll catch up a little bit.
Yeah, good. Yeah, look forward to it.
Looking forward to it, Jeff. All Thanks right. for your time.
Thanks, Tony. Bye-bye. Bye.
Ping. Play your best.
Our partners are very important to Edgar, and I would like to introduce you to a short, true story told by Ping.
In 1959, Carsten designed a putter that he went on to call the 1A. This was probably the first putter ever designed by a professional engineer. It looked nothing like the golf world had ever seen. The head was made from material never used before in club making. The face was floating, attached only at the heel and toe. Carsten had invented perimeter weighting. He knew by moving the weight around the perimeter of the putter head, it would drastically minimize twisting on off-centered struck putts. The stable head produced a level of forgiveness and accuracy that made the game easier. With his first prototype design of the 1A putter, he drilled a hole in the head and put a shaft in it. When he putted a ball on the floor, the design made a ping sound. Carsten immediately recognized the significance of the sound. Not only was his new putter a step forward in putter design, it had a unique musical marketing angle and subsequently provided a distinctive name for the business. Ping. What other name could he call it?
This was an Edgar Player story supported by Ping, helping golfers to play their best. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Stay tuned for the next Edgar podcast. Ping. Play your best.